Albert Memmi was a Tunisian Jew born in 1920, a philosopher and political thinker educated at the Sorbonne. He was also an activist and revolutionary who fought for Tunisian independence, which was achieved in 1952. The new state of Tunisia made Islam the official religion of state and published several anti-Jewish decrees. Memmi found himself officially excluded from a state which he had supported before its founding and indeed continued to support. Memmi's book, The Colonizer and the Colonized, is a brilliant analysis of the impact of the colonial situation on both the colonized, which he identified with as a Tunisian, and the colonizer, which he identified with as a Jewish Tunisian, which identity gave him a slight privilege relative to his fellow Tunisians in the colonial hierarchy. Since this is a podcast about the U.S. left, before I enter into a discussion of the Middle East, I want to dwell a moment on Memmi's cutting perceptions of colonizer allyship. Afterwards, I'm going to briefly go over the long history of Syria before offering a criticism of the nationalist regime of Hafez al-Assad. By the end of this podcast, we will understand why the Arab Spring announced the failure of the anti-colonial project in the Middle East and why this failure didn't register with certain Western leftists. Western leftists typically feel a contradiction between the need to show solidarity with anti-colonial movements and the need to champion human rights when those movements fall short. Terrorism, for instance, is a tactic that causes a lot of damage and harm to civilian populations, and the leftists who feel the need for solidarity with independence movements who are practicing terrorism, they have to compartmentalize their politics. In one box is the right to life and liberty. In the other box is the anti-colonial struggle. For the third campist radical, there can never be a moment when the right to life in the one box is allowed to peek into the anti-colonialist box. And the history of anti-colonial regimes is also pretty bad about women's rights. So also the box where you put women's rights can't peek over into the box where you talk about independence movements. Even paying attention to human rights abuses by third world governments can be considered a betrayal. Crucially, Memmi sees in this inability to hold anti-colonialist rebels to the same standard as we hold our own governments as a further form of racism. To imagine that terrorism is a natural event, one completely beyond the ability of colonized people to understand or control or resist, is to frame the colonized subject as subhuman. Like any such relationship where someone, in this case a patronizing Western leftist, imagines themselves to have agency, while an other, in this case the colonized terrorist, while that other does not, the relationship disfigures the humanity of both. The colonizer ally who decides that what a colonized person does is beyond ethics then has to ascribe to a kind of racial hierarchy where certain peoples, the proletarian nations as some thinkers call them, are allowed to murder indiscriminately, can have legitimate governments who do so, and where certain other governments, Western ones, must be held to perhaps an impossibly high standard. This is how Memmi thinks we reached a moment where leftists take a totally permissive attitude towards every nationalist movement worldwide, no matter how awful, except for Israel, whom they imagine should destroy itself. Memmi, as a self-described Arab Jew and left Zionist, represents a challenge to us about our basic values. He never renounced the cause of Tunisian independence, never championed the rights of one group at the expense of the rights of another. And while it is true he supported Israel's right to self-defense, he never failed to extend the same to Palestinians and Arabs. He finds that denouncing all tyranny at the same time is less hypocritical than favoring a supposed underdog. What he represents, then, is the challenge to morally hypocritical thinking about the conflict as such. To the Manichaean left, There are proletarian and bourgeois nations, whole nations of angels and devils. It's not that much different from the absolute enemy-friend thinking of white supremacists. If Bashar al-Assad has to murder Sunnis to stay in power, that is fine. But if Israel fails to stop West Bank expansion, then Israel should be abolished. The naturalization of this hierarchy of legitimate national struggles, Syria, and illegitimate ones, Israel, is a consequence of the original hypocrisy according to which the murder of innocent people is okay if it's done by anti-colonialists. The idea that brutal dictatorships in the Middle East are legitimate governments held by a certain kind of U.S. leftist, and the willingness of the U.S. government to lend strategic support to those dictatorships, for instance, the long-standing support of Saddam Hussein that ended in the 90s, were both challenged by the Arab Spring. It turns out that Middle Eastern people are not satisfied living under authoritarian governments, and those governments deployed an anti-Semitic rhetoric without really doing much to help the Palestinians. Memmi was particularly well-positioned to understand this patronizing version of allyship, according to which the anti-colonialist is not subject to any kind of ethical constraint, because Memmi had supported independence and then suffered oppression at the hands of the Tunisian government he helped to establish. And I'll say it one more time, why not? It never gets old, and I'm not sure it's been understood. There are no angels or devils in power. In power, there are only trade-offs between values, and the people who have to make those trade-offs based on limited information. Memmi was able to support an anti-colonial independence movement and at the same time criticize it, and that is a good example to the rest of us. But the U.S. left still seems to see America as an absolute enemy, and sees those who declare themselves America's enemies as beyond criticism. It's a superstition, and like the monarchist ideology of the pre-modern period, it rests on a conception of the world where political relationships are natural, are foreordained, where authority is not about probity or clarity, democracy or popular will, but based on the authority of persons. And because this new divinely ordained political hierarchy is founded on generalizations, I want to attack it by investigating the specific situation in Syria. In the trailer, I discussed my background growing up poor in the 80s and joining the Navy to learn Arabic after September 11th. When the revolution happened there in 2011, it was happening down the street from where I used to live, happening to people who were my friends. It was from that moment I began engaging with politics in a different way. Among other things, this podcast is an attempt to come to terms with that engagement, to make an accounting for it. I was able, thanks to my activism and thanks to my linguistic skills, to translate various articles and statements into and out of Arabic for different revolutionary groups around the Middle East. At the time, I felt guilt for having contributed to U.S. wars overseas, and I felt like I was giving something back. Even today, if anyone listening in the revolutionary movement in the Middle East, if they need translations done, please at me. I'm good, and I'll work for free. This engagement with the Middle East is why I'm a socialist. I want to talk about the history of Syria and the Arab Spring in some depth, because the nature of the revolution cannot be understood without an appreciation of Syria's ancient connectedness with the rest of the world. In the passages that follow, I have focused somewhat on historical turning points. And I think it's tempting to imagine that the region has been at war for thousands of years when history is presented in this way. This is deeply unfortunate. The history shows long periods of stability and peace, punctuated by occasionally violent moments of change. The one constant in Syria's history from ancient times is its contact with the whole world as a crossroads between East and West. We'll start far enough back that we get an idea of what made a place like Syria possible. from Harani. Quote, Syria was linked closely with the rest of the eastern Mediterranean basin by sea routes from its ports and by the land route running along the coast to Egypt. The combination of long-distance trade with the production of a surplus of foodstuffs and raw materials had made possible the growth of large cities lying in the inner plains but linked with the coast, Aleppo in the north and Damascus in the center. Unquote. When the Prophet Muhammad died, his followers rapidly took by conquest the entire Middle East and North Africa. The center of their empire was Syria. These early Muslims were taking advantage of a decline of the traditional ruling powers and tying together a very real globalist network. They legitimately represented the advance of civilization, and their rule was just and welcomed almost everywhere they went. From Harani, quote, In the space of a few years, then, the political frontiers of the Near East had been changed, and the center of political life had moved from the rich and populous lands of the Fertile Crescent to a small town lying on the edge of the world of high culture and wealth. The change was so sudden and unexpected that it needs explanation. Evidence uncovered by archaeologists indicates that the prosperity and strength of the Mediterranean world were in decline because of barbarian invasions, failure to maintain terraces and other agricultural works, and the shrinking of the urban market. Both Byzantine and the Sasanian empires had been weakened by epidemics of plague and long wars. The hold of the Byzantines over Syria had been restored only after the defeat of the Sasanians in 629 and was still tenuous. The Arabs who invaded the two empires were not a tribal horde, but an organized force. When Muawiyah died, he was succeeded by his son, who was followed briefly by his own son. After that, there was a second period of civil war, and the throne passed to another branch of the family. The change was more than one of rulers. The capital of the empire moved to Damascus, a city lying in a countryside able to provide the surplus needed to maintain a court, government, and army, and a region from which the eastern Mediterranean coastlands and the land of the east of them could be controlled more easily than from Medina. Unquote. The Crusades were an utter disaster for the Arabic-speaking world. That world had witnessed by that point a long period of stability and great advances in the science. When the first Crusaders arrived in Syria, they were so starved from their long trek from France across Anatolia that they cannibalized the civilian population of the first city they encountered, which was Antioch. Amin Maalouf's The Crusades Through Arab Eyes is well worth reading. I'll quote from it here at length. Maalouf. If the West had sought, through its successive invasions, to contain the thrust of Islam, the result was exactly the opposite. Not only were the Frankish states of the Middle East uprooted after two centuries of colonization, but the Muslims had so completely gained the upper hand that before long, under the banner of the Ottoman Turks, they would seek to conquer Europe itself. In 1453, they took Constantinople. By 1529, their cavalry was encamped at the walls of Vienna. At the time of the Crusades, the Arab world, from Spain to Iraq, was still the intellectual and material repository of the planet's most advanced civilization. Afterwards, the center of the world history shifted decisively to the West. In all domains, the French learned much in the Arab school, in Syria as in Spain and Sicily. What they learned from the Arabs was indispensable in their subsequent expansion. The heritage of Greek civilization was transmitted to Western Europe through Arab intermediaries, both translators and continuators. In medicine, astronomy, chemistry, geography, mathematics, and architecture, the French drew their knowledge from Arabic books, which they assimilated, imitated, and then surpassed. Many words bear testimony to this even today. Zenith, nadir, azimuth, algebra, algorithm, almanac, and more, simply cipher. In the realm of industry, the Europeans first learned and then later improved upon the processes used by the Arabs in papermaking, leatherworking, textiles, and the distillation of alcohol and sugar, two more words borrowed from the Arabic language. Although the epoch of the Crusades ignited a genuine economic and cultural revolution in Western Europe, in the Orient, these holy wars led to long centuries of decadence and obscurantism. Assaulted from all quarters, the Muslim world turned in on itself. Unquote. As the Byzantine Empire unraveled in the early 15th century, Turkish tribes stepped into the vacuum, and in 1453 they conquered Constantinople, called it Istanbul, and progressed over the course of the next century to conquer modern-day Iraq, the Arabian Peninsula, the Levant, Eastern Europe, and North Africa, as far as modern Algeria. From Harani, the Syrian provinces of Aleppo, Damascus, and Tripoli had to be controlled directly because of their tax revenues. The place of Aleppo in the international trading system, that of Damascus is one of the centers from which pilgrimage was organized, and that of Jerusalem and Hebron as holy cities. The government in Istanbul was able to retain direct control both of the roads through Anatolia and by sea, but this was limited to the great cities and the grain-producing plains around them, and the ports of the coast. In the mountains and desert, control was more difficult because of the terrain, and less important because the land produced less revenue. It was enough for the Ottoman government to give recognition to local families of lords, provided they collected and transmitted revenue and did not threaten the routes by which trade and armies passed. In the same way, chiefs of pastoral tribes in the Syrian desert and those lying on the pilgrims' route to Mecca were given formal recognition, a policy of manipulation, of setting one family or member of a family against another, was usually sufficient to preserve the balance between imperial and local interests, but sometimes it could be threatened. In the early 17th century, a rebellious governor of Aleppo and an overpowerful lord in the Shouf Mountains of Lebanon, Fakhr al-Din al-Ma'ani, with some encouragement from Italian rulers, were able to challenge Ottoman power for a time. Fakhr al-Din was finally captured and executed, and after that, the Ottomans established a fourth province with its capital in Saida to keep a watch over the lords of Lebanon. Now we'll get into, finally, the European imperialism. Today, when we talk about imperialism, it usually involves a discussion of bad faith. For instance, the reasons the U.S., say, went to war in Iraq were explicitly containment of weapons of mass destruction and spreading democracy. We call it imperialism, assuming that the reasons given are lies or bad faith beliefs. Things were otherwise in 19th century Europe. There were large pro-imperialist parties, usually liberal in the sense that they affirmed limited or even broken democratic systems. Colonies were how they hoped to ease poverty and unemployment, and where the middle classes could get rich. That's the sort of milieu that supported Napoleon III and his colony in Algeria in the 1830s, for instance, and similar dynamics were at work in British-ruled India, the U.S. and Philippines. It goes on and on and on. These are just a few examples. Socialists such as Beatrice Webb and George Bernard Shaw were imperialists, for instance. And usually these imperialisms found some kind of justification in a version of white man's burden. These were racist ideologies whose adherents put forth a straightforward, good faith case for imperialism. We've discussed elsewhere the kind of racist eugenics ideology that prevailed just before the turn of the 20th century. Throughout that century, the British were busy invading, occupying, and getting kicked out of Mesopotamia and the Levant. In the run-up to World War I, Turkey had its strength sapped fighting the Italians in Libya and in the Balkans. Syria remained a part of the Ottoman Empire until the British, out of desperation during World War I, enlisted the aid of Arabic-speaking princes who had ambitions to finally set up their own independent states, something they had lost under nearly four centuries of Turkish rule. The post-war settlement of Sykes-Picot gave France status in Lebanon and Syria to manage them and nominally to help them transition into independence. But the French didn't really seem to be offering independence, and at many key points, they jailed or killed locals who showed initiative towards building independent local institutions. In 1925, as Abdul Karim was devastating the Spanish army in Morocco and opening a second front against the French there, nationalists in Syria reckoned the time was right. The French had been administering Syria as a loose confederation. This meant that the Alawites and the Druze, in particular, had autonomy relative to the peoples all around them. This is typical divide and conquer. As we shall see, this will be exactly how the Ossid dynasty would later rule, right down to the exact ethnic divisions that the French and the Ossids manipulated. One veteran of an early desperate attempt to fight back French rule in 1920 at Maysalun was Fawzi al-Kawukji. He was from Hama. Because the French had tried to replace the Druze leader Sultan Pasha al-Atrash, the Druze were already by the spring of 1923 waging guerrilla war against the French. Al-Kawukji in Hama and Abdulrahman Shahbandar from Damascus convinced the Druze to escalate their offensive. In return, they promised to lead an expansion of the insurrection in Damascus and Hama. With French troops tied down in Morocco, fighting Abdul Karim, so they reasoned, they had a good chance of pushing the French out of Syria. The nation rallied to their cause, with mass demonstrations and with popular support for the guerrillas. The French put down the revolt with a disgusting display of extreme violence against civilian populations, shelling civilian areas and massacring non-combatants in insurgent territory. Notably, one of the communities that took heavy casualties was the Ghouta, a fertile valley just to the east of Damascus. The Ghouta was the neighborhood that hosted a 400-year-old merchants' guild. Projecting ahead some, it was in the Ghouta that Bashar al-Assad killed 1,400 people with sarin nerve agent in 2013. There is something about the Ghouta's centuries-long access to trade, its connections with the rest of the world, its status as a source of wealth independent from the current authority, that make it a perennial site of rebellion against tyranny. It is estimated that in 3 days in October 1925, 1,500 people were massacred by the French. You have to suspect that locals then told stories about the French crusaders who cannibalized the people of Antioch so long ago. Again and again, we've pointed out that the source of legitimate rule is protecting the masses. And on this score, if on nothing else, the French had failed. Nevertheless, they managed to quell the rebellion in 1926 and stuck around until after World War II. The socialist government under Leon Blum, which we've talked about in our episode about the Spanish Civil War and how dysfunctional it was. But at any rate, that government of Blum's tried to give Syria real independence, but was blocked from debating the matter by the colonial lobby in Paris. Syria felt some of the aftershocks of the French Revolution during the war when a restoration government under Vichy's man Dentz was replaced by the Republican de Gaulle with the help of the British Army. Even in the colonies, France must have a periodic revolution. Conservatives and colonialists there come directly out of the tradition of rural resistance to the Jacobins, and the decision to nationalize the Catholic Church there just keeps coming back to cause chaos. After World War II, protests erupt anew across Syria, and just as in 1925, the French responded with extreme brutality. And then, something remarkable happened. The indiscriminate bombing of civilian areas did not sit well with the new English Prime Minister. After nearly half a century of patient organizing and being a minority party in coalitions with other political parties, British Labour had come into its own. From Dorian, quote, "Labour played a significant role in Winston Churchill's wartime coalition government, which set up Clement Attlee to become Prime Minister after the war ended. The Attlee government of 1945 to 1951 transformed Britain into a British version of social democracy. Labour made healthcare a fundamental right for all citizens, nationalised 1/5 of the economy, significantly increased the incomes of wage earners, sustained the full employment economy that the war created, instituted progressive income tax and a pension system, abolished anti-union laws, abolished restrictions on the rights of women to own property, established a minimum wage for agricultural workers, and got colonial Britain out of India, Pakistan, Burma, Myanmar, Ceylon, Sri Lanka, and Palestine, unquote. We can add to this list of victories convincing France to grant Syrian independence. Labour could do all of these things because it had helped the reactionary Churchill government during World War II. Attlee, in fact, was his defense minister. Earning the trust and goodwill of the people by honest debate and wise cooperation has always served us better than constantly declaring war on everyone who doesn't agree with us. In 1945, the Labour Party proved as much by transforming a large part of the world for the better. When I think about Lenin's theories of imperialism, and then find an instance like this of an imperial country doing something that isn't favored in the so-called iron laws of capitalism, I'm reminded that people have agency, and that affirming that by organizing for a larger democracy opens up the possibility of intentional human action to change the world. To be clear, I don't think Lenin saw the rules of imperialism as overpowering human agency, but I do think that many of his successors think that. We'll come back to that. From Eugene Rogan, quote, "From his safe house in Salahia, President Kowatli appealed to British officials to intervene. Invoking the 1941 guarantee of Syrian independence, he formally requested the British to intercede with the French to stop the bombardment of Damascus. The Syrian president's appeal gave Britain legitimate grounds to interfere in French imperial affairs, and they prevailed upon their wartime ally to lift their attack. By the time French guns fell silent, more than 400 Syrians had been killed, hundreds of private homes had been destroyed, and the building that housed the Syrian parliament had been reduced to rubble by the ferocity of the attack. France's desperate bid to preserve its empire in the Levant had failed, and nothing could persuade the embittered Syrians to compromise in their long-standing demand for total independence. The French finally admitted defeat in July 1945 and agreed to transfer control of the military and security forces to the independent governments of Syria and Lebanon." After World War II, as Europe began to pull back from empire and the Cold War heated up, the United States was barely getting started with international espionage. The CIA was a hot mess, and they got involved in a lot of places in the name of anti-communism. Mainly, they had no idea what they were doing. In his expansive history of the CIA, Tim Weiner discusses the U.S.-backed military coup in Syria of 1949. President Eisenhower had some racist ideas about Arabs not being able to understand democracy, so he insisted that the CIA try and find and fund partners in the region who would engage, in Eisenhower's words, in an Islamic jihad against communism. It's worth pondering the nature of military coups for a moment. Nanahal Singh has done us a very great service in this regard. In his book, Seizing Power, The Strategic Logic of Military Coups, Singh studied in depth 7 of the 10 military coups that occurred in Ghana after it was granted independence from Great Britain, from 1966 to 1983. Quote, "I skipped the first attempt because it has already been fairly well documented, and omit the last 2 because they add little original to our theoretical understanding. Ghana was originally chosen as a site for this research because it had a high number of coup attempts that were almost evenly split between successes and failures, which is similar to the distribution of coup outcomes worldwide. It also had a variety of potentially relevant background conditions, with, for example, coup attempts from the top, middle, and bottom of the military hierarchy. In addition, Ghana's coup attempts were recent enough to make conducting oral history feasible, yet far enough in the past that participants were willing to speak freely about events once I had obtained their trust, unquote. We can't really have absolutely rigorous scientific knowledge of history. There's no way to rerun events with one or two variables changed to see what difference it would make. There's no way to know for sure, for instance, whether if JFK were not assassinated, we would have stayed in Vietnam as long as we did. We just can't run experiments that way. But Singh has gotten remarkably close to finding such a data set, where the same thing is attempted with some perhaps minor changes. Here's what the data told him. In a military coup, the outcome is decided by who can convince the majority of the armed forces, not that their platform is preferable, but that the outcome is decided in their favor. Most military forces will take a sit-and-wait attitude when they are aware of a coup, because the overwhelming impulse is to avoid shedding the blood of one's compatriots. Coups succeed when they can make a compelling case that they cannot be helpfully resisted. Coups are more likely to succeed from the top because the upper chain of command can hold meetings where they announce the coup to key players. By forcing key players to pick a side in a public forum before any of them have had a chance to discuss matters in private, generates a social pressure to support the coup. If the conspirators can seize the media early and control the message, then they can easily convince the nation that the coup has succeeded and that resistance is futile. It's not exactly an election where people can freely say what they want, nor is it a battle where the two sides are clearly differentiated and bloodshed is unavoidable. The general public can influence the outcome of a military coup if members of the military are given the chance to discuss things with them. We cite the example of the Russian Revolution, where long discussion and many votes by popular organized bodies, such as the Soviets, came before and then blessed after the fact the Bolsheviks leading parts of the Russian army to seize the Winter Palace. Another example is the failed coup against Charles de Gaulle in 1961. Several retired French generals tried to take over the government to stop the French from withdrawing from their colony in Algeria. The coup attempt had broad support throughout the officer corps. Decisively, de Gaulle was able to go on television to publicly repudiate the generals, citing a referendum a few months earlier where the French people had voted to give up the French colony. Al-Zaim's government, by the way, apparently had the blessing of the U.S., but was self-initiated. Any group aspiring to power, whether that group is democratic or not, would probably be helping itself if it got the backing of some external power. I'm laying all of this out like this, not to say that Al-Zaim or Shishakli were good people that deserved to rule Syria, or because I agree with the pan-Arabism of the one, or the far-right Syria-first ideology of the second. I just want all of this to be known because it destroys the two-dimensional version of these events people usually put forward, that the U.S. paid money to impose a government on local Arabs, who in this story have no will or agency of their own, in order to support Israel, or the Zionists, or the Wahhabi Zionists, or whatever other deep state surrogate they think controls the U.S. government. The CIA put their hand on the scale in Syria to oppose Stalinist totalitarian communism, and in so doing, they put a Syrian nationalist authoritarian in power, someone opposed to Israel, but also opposed to Syria combining with Iraq. Like most of these CIA interventions, the U.S. didn't get everything they wanted, and success hinged largely on how much local support they could count on. After 4 years in power, Shishakli was deposed in another coup, this time backed by Baathists, communists, and military officers. The fact that civil society was involved in all of these coups shows that regular people were demanding action to change their government, and that they were in part getting what they wanted, and then realizing it wasn't what they wanted, and then demanding something else. The fact that democratic institutions didn't materialize is a real failure, but one that cannot be explained because of U.S. intervention. Long-term success of a coup-installed government still seems to depend largely on whether society will tolerate that government. That was the case with the Egyptian regime, which was actually very popular under Nasser, but resulted from a military coup. In 1957, the U.S. tried to promote a coup again, but local Syrian military officers knew the tune already, so they set up a sting and expelled the plotters. The U.S. then expelled the Syrian ambassador, probably a mistake in hindsight. The resulting decline in American prestige in the region, among other factors, led to local governments welcoming Soviet Russian aid and influence. Gamal Abdel Nasser coined the term Third World to designate the aspiration for a coalition of states not beholden to the U.S. or to the USSR. But when Washington found out that Nasser was getting aid from the USSR for his Aswan Dam project, the U.S. withdrew its aid for the project, so Nasser ended up in the Soviet Union's orbit. Back in Syria, the new economy was lifting up a class of traditionally lower to middle position peasant farmers. This peasant class would struggle through the chaos of these years to take power in Syria, first by a fairly generous redistribution of wealth, and later by an intensification of poverty, exploitation, and finally by violent collective punishment. In 1999, Hanna Batatu published his now classic ethnographic study of Syria's ruling class entitled Syria's Peasantry, the Descendants of Its Lesser Rural Notables and Their Politics. The regime that coalesced around Hafez al-Assad achieved enduring stability by 1974. Batatu comments, out of the 19 Alawi who filled or fill positions at this level of the power structure, no fewer than 11, or 57.9%, descend from the lesser rural or village notability, which owned land, but on a small or middling scale, and while not wealthy, enjoyed influence and prestige among the local peasants. Only 3, or 15.8% of descendants are sharecroppers. In other words, the majority does not come from families at the lower end of the rural income or status ladder, unquote. When the French set up local semi-autonomous zones, such as those for the Alawi and the Druze, they were setting up across the country multiple administrations, with rural notables being elevated to the same level as the urban elites who had occupied privileged places within the Ottoman system. Batatu exhaustively documents how, throughout this period, the land holdings of these middling class peasant strata increased tenfold. The Alawi were historically a very poor economic class, and the French enlisted them heavily in the Troupe Speciale. Moreover, because they didn't have the same extended networks of social wealth that other Syrians had, Alawi tended to rely on and support the Ba'ath Party, whose political fortunes soared in the middle 20th century. The Ba'ath Party's rise to power came about in three successive stages, expertly laid out by Batatu. First, the Ba'ath united with the Socialist Party, then they suppressed the leadership of the Socialist Party, and then Hafez al-Assad subdued his rivals inside the Ba'ath Party. Like most liberation movements in the late 19th and early 20th century, the Syrian movement was dominated by socialism and nationalism. Nationalism took the form of the Ba'ath Party, and the socialist idea was championed by Akram Hawrani, whose Arab Socialist Party had this great slogan, bring shovel and brush to bury lord and boss. In the first stage, from 1945 to 1952, the Ba'ath Party had its base of support in the urban centers. These Ba'ath were soft on inherited privilege and hard against foreign intervention. They had a vision of the nationally united Syria forged in the furnace of European colonialism. The population all around, the peasants and day laborers of Syria, were embracing socialism in the context of an Ottoman-style system that had been balkanized by the French administration. In 1952, these two parties joined forces. Over the next 20 years, the Ba'athists would maneuver to bring more peasant notables into privileged positions and to marginalize the leadership of the increasingly defunct Socialist Party. By the way, the Syrian Communist Party was dead on arrival throughout this period because they followed Stalin's dictate that they should support, one, landowners, since Syria was supposedly still fighting for its national independence and should therefore unite under the feudal remnants, and two, because the CP supported the partition of Palestine. This is yet another way the priorities of Moscow undermined the interests of various Communist Party locals around the world. There were always two kinds of nationalism in Syria. One part of the Ba'ath Party wanted a state based in the historic Levant that was specifically Syrian, and one part always wanted Syria to contribute to a greater Arab state. In 1958, the latter won out, and Syria joined Egypt in the United Arab Republic. Abdel Nasser came on a little too strong for the Syrian Ba'athists, and the experiment fell apart in 1961. After the unification of the Arab Socialist Party and the Ba'ath Party in 1952, the latter gradually dominated politics. In the army, the various Sunni ethnic groups competed with each other for influence. Because they outnumbered other groups in the French-organized local militia, several Alawi held positions in the high military ranks. Throughout the 60s, in the context of the lack of coordination among Sunni groups, the Alawi at the top of the military chain of command were able to use their position to regulate entry into the military academies and to shift the command structure to benefit themselves in a social context saturated with nepotism. These were not necessarily official policies or perhaps even particularly intentional, but in context, people clearly had identifications that were important enough for them to embrace corruption of the national institutions to the benefit of their extended family. By the end of this second phase, the Ba'ath Party was transformed into a party that had its center of mass in the countryside, and the Arab Socialist Party had become a deleveraged junior partner. What the Socialist Party politics achieved in this union was aggressive and far-reaching land redistribution. The land redistribution was slow at first, and then through 1968 and 69 sped up as Salah Jadid took leadership in coordination with Cairo. Jadid was an Alawite, but he rose up through the military ranks, pretty typically. Close beneath him in the hierarchy was a young up-and-comer named Hafez al-Assad. Hafez al-Assad was the first peasant and the first Alawite to become the ruler of Syria. The Alawite religion is surrounded by mystery, with the core tenets being known only to the initiated. Hafez al-Assad was likewise described by many who knew him personally as secretive and inscrutable. His family were agricultural laborers, part of an important clan local in Kirdaha, a village in Latakia. Hafez al-Assad's father, Ali Suleiman, was a harsh and abusive head of the family. There are rumors that Ali Suleiman beat Hafez's older brother Bayat so badly one day for having misspent some money that Bayat, having been forced to sleep in the barn that night, hung himself in shame. Quote, from Batatu, Hafez al-Assad, who was then only 8 years old, is said to have told a friend sometime after his graduation from military academy, since the day I saw my brother suspended by the neck in the barn, no tear has fallen from my eye. Unquote. Having excelled in memorization of the Quran, Hafez was sent away to primary school in Latakia. From there, he took the path that many young Alawite men did to better their social standing. He joined the military academy. Sam Dagher writes, it was fall 1952 when Hafez al-Assad and Mustafa Talas first met at the military academy in the city of Homs. It was a natural choice for poor, scrappy young men from the provinces, like Hafez and Mustafa, who were ambitious and politically minded. A ninth grade education and an entrance exam were all it took to be admitted. Recruits were housed, fed, and paid a stipend. Before the academy, Hafez and Mustafa were young leaders in the Ba'ath Party, which was formed a year after Syria's independence. The Ba'ath was first and foremost an ideology, a curious fusion of European philosophies, socialism, Arab nationalism, and Islamic thought, whose theorists were Syrian graduates of the Sorbonne. Its core doctrine was that Arabs must undergo transformation and unification beyond just geographic and political lines. They must shed imperial-era influences and return to their pure essence and virtues. This demanded a rebirth and resurgence, or Ba'ath in Arabic. These concepts, along with social equality and redistribution of wealth, appealed to those sidelined by the economic circumstances like Mustafa, or by belonging to religious minorities like Hafez. Arab identity was supposed to transcend all cleavages. End quote. In 1963, Hafez al-Assad and several of his fellow cadets from the military academy, with backing from some of the top brass, posed as an opposition to secession from Egypt and staged a coup. Tanks rolled into Damascus. Hafez secured the nearby airport. The purge that followed lifted more Ba'athists into power. When the pro-Nasser group realized they had been lied to and betrayed, they led their own coup, which failed. In 1964, the new regime put down revolts in Homs and Hama, led by Marwan Hadid, who afterwards was given a death sentence. The sentence was reversed, despite the protestations of Hafez and Mustafa. What followed was deadly court intrigue, with the result that Salah Jadid took power, who, as we discussed previously, implemented aggressive land redistribution. In June of 1967, Israel invaded the Golan Heights. Hafez al-Assad, despite his experience in military coups, was still inexperienced in combat. On June 10th, he issued Communique 66, Communique 66, declaring that Israeli forces had taken the village of Quneitra. But Israeli forces were not anywhere near Quneitra. When they saw the Syrian tanks retreating, they easily entered and took over the Golan. Hafez al-Assad had led the retreat without having put up a fight. It's possible to explain this action as cowardice, inexperience, or incompetence. There were unverified reports of Israeli tanks in and around Quneitra. It seems likely that Hafez al-Assad didn't want to risk his tanks in battle when the position of his ruling clique was so tenuous at home. In 1973, Hafez al-Assad distinguished himself by taking back part of the Golan from Israel in a war that saw Egypt retake the Sinai Peninsula. The undemocratic seizure of power by Ba'athists and the economic pressures of the 70s alienated large parts of Syrian society. The Arab Socialist Party, which had begun in 1939 and had its large base of support in and around Hama, became a center of resistance. It was incredibly popular. It had 40,000 people at its congress in 1950. The bonds of solidarity it forged, as well as the culture of resistance, lived on in the Syrian countryside. With the world recession of the 70s added in, this older political movement was bound to butt heads with the authoritarian and corrupt Assad regime. In 1979, Egypt concluded a peace treaty with Israel. It has held to this day, and thereby Egypt removed the potential for a repeat of 1973 when Egypt and Syria joined forces to attack Israel. We have seen how the Ba'ath Party was transformed by its merger with the ASP from a party of army officers and urban intellectuals into a mass peasant party. Populations within which individuals and groups may have aspired to socialism, to the democratic control of the means of production, found the path open to them for advancement in the nationalist wing of the Ba'ath. In the early 70s, Hafez al-Assad began holding mass rallies where people were coerced into attending and engaging there in worship of Hafez himself. Lisa Wedeen notes, quote, outlandish declarations of loyalty to Assad increased by the late 70s and early 1980s, when the poor performance of the Syrian economy and Syrians' perceptions of mismanagement and corruption contributed to growing opposition to the Assad regime, unquote. At the same time, a campaign of terror was waged by the regime. Thousands were sent to prison to be tortured. Sam Dagher recounts the events of the late 70s and early 80s through the memories of Hama native and artist Khaled Al-Khani. Quote, there had been soldiers in khaki green in Hama as far back as Khaled Al-Khani could remember. He was barely 4 years old in 1979 when Hafez al-Assad stepped up the pressure on his hometown. It was common that year to see troops in jeeps and pickup trucks with machine guns racing down Corniche al-Assi, the riverside promenade with lush parks and giant wooden water wheels, or norias, used for millennia to scoop water from the deeply carved Orontes River into aqueducts for irrigation. There was no telling when the heavy footsteps of soldiers would echo through the narrow cobblestone alleyways on their way to arrest people from their homes, shops, and schools. Thousands were sent to the Mukhabarat's torture dungeons and then eastward to the infamous Tadmor Desert Prison, described as, quote, the kingdom of death and madness by a poet held there for 5 years. The dragnets in Hama often provoked angry protests and general strikes, which then led to more repression by regime forces. While fear and violent confrontation gripped Hama that year, Khaled and his siblings were somewhat shielded from it despite the political activism of their father, Hikmet Al-Khani, an eye doctor and community leader. Soldiers at checkpoints, demanding IDs, and searching vehicles were often smiley and playful with little Khaled, a cute and chubby boy with blonde hair and blue eyes. Hafez was already enmeshed in the civil war in neighboring Lebanon, and he faced challenges on two fronts at home. Attacks by Islamist insurgents backed by his rival Ba'athist regime in Iraq, and rising discontent by a large cross-section of the population over economic mismanagement, corruption, and an increasingly authoritarian rule. The insurgents were part of Tala al-Muqatala, or Fighting Vanguard, a militant splinter group of the Muslim Brotherhood Party, which first emerged in Hama when Ba'athist took power in 1963. The Muslim Brotherhood was divided over the vanguard's claims, and a wing of the party advocated dialogue with Hafez to convince him to implement real reforms and ease his grip on public life. And to that end, it cooperated with the likes of Hikmet Al-Khani and Omar Shishakli, a famous doctor and the nephew of Adib Shishakli, the former ruler of Syria we spoke about earlier. But it was precisely such nonviolent collaboration that Hafez felt jeopardized his authority. So Hafez's overriding strategy was to wage military campaigns against entire cities and towns like Aleppo and Hama, from which Brotherhood leaders hailed, under the guise of combating terrorism. There were mass arrests, summary executions, unspeakable torture in prisons of anyone suspected of having even the remotest link to the Brotherhood. This guilt by association extended to family members, friends, and acquaintances. All too often, many people met a tragic demise due to their name, birthplace, or look, or simply because of mistaken identity. Unquote. In the early months of 1980, the stream of events came to a head, and a wave of strikes and protests begun in Hama soon spread to Aleppo, Banias, Homs, and Latakia. Omar al-Shishakli was called to a meeting with Mustafa Talas, Hafez al-Assad's old friend from military academy days. Al-Shishakli was tortured and murdered. Several other leaders of the peaceful protest movement of 1980 were likewise murdered. Having decapitated the peaceful protest movement, Assad could carry on with the collective punishment of rebellious communities in the name of fighting terrorism. That year, he subdued Aleppo, killing 2,000 and arresting another 8,000. In the cold days of early February 1982, Hafez al-Assad's forces encircled Hama. The captains on the ground were mainly Alawite. They rampaged the city in a campaign of ethnic cleansing.
Estimates of the number of dead range from 10,000 to 25,000. Dozens of neighborhoods were completely razed to the ground. The government's reckoning of the number of Muslim Brotherhood in the city was no more than 500. Those who survived often lived under the shadow of the knowledge that their loved ones had been taken to some jail to be tortured indefinitely. Sometimes people came back. Sometimes news of someone's death came back instead. Khalid al-Khani survived, and like many Hama natives, he tried to join the Ba'ath Party in the hopes of getting into college. A Ba'ath committee came to his high school to interview the potential new recruits. It's like joining Junior ROTC. They asked him what his father's name and profession were. He said that his father had been killed by the army. From Sam Dagher, quote, "All six got up, removed their jackets, and took turns slapping and punching Khalid. He was knocked to the floor and screamed as he was kicked. The principal rescued him. Quote, I'm so sorry, gentlemen. Leave it to me. I'm going to teach this scoundrel a lesson," said the principal as he escorted Khalid out of the room and hid him in his office. Khalid was supposed to say that Islamist terrorists had killed his father. He was supposed to forget those who witnessed his father being captured by regime forces and taken with thousands of other men to the porcelain factory, where he was tortured and gruesomely executed. Hamawi had to live with the regime's lies, even in the privacy of their homes. To cope, many massacre survivors became convinced that Hafez was the nation's strict yet benevolent father who punished Hama only because he was left with no other choice. The uncontestable truth was that the regime had meticulously planned the assault on Hama in 1982, completely subdued a few hundred Islamist fighters in about 10 days, then vengefully massacred thousands of civilians, raped women, looted homes, and razed neighborhoods, and then at the end wanted victims to believe that terrorists had done it, unquote. Hama, the birthplace of Syria's socialist movement, rose up in the late 70s against the rising authoritarianism. The spirit of solidarity shown in the spreading protest movement is all the best of what democratic socialism should be. People fighting to have a say in what happens in their lives. Syria is a place where the whole world comes together, where ancient Greek philosophy and algebra were rediscovered by Europe through the Crusades. That enlightenment and culture, Assad Syria had to kill all of that. And for 30 years, it would seem he had. Syria's isolation in the region after the peace deal between Egypt and Israel is probably part of why Hafez al-Assad refused to intervene militarily when Israel invaded Lebanon in 1982, displacing 500,000 people, indiscriminately bombing civilian neighborhoods, and intentionally allowing phalangists to massacre Palestinian refugees at Sabra and Shatila. But as Hanna Batatu rightly points out, this must have deeply offended Syrians who witnessed this refusal to face the Israelis at the same moment that the regime was cleansing Hama, Aleppo, and a dozen other places and disciplining civil society to never, ever ask for anything better. After Hama, the Assad regime didn't face any real threats to its power until 2011. The dual compulsion to rally, to worship the cult of Assad, and to remain silent about any and all abuses and shortcomings of the regime was the norm for 30 years. It was a time when society was completely dominated by the state. It was a fulfillment of Robespierre's dream. As we will see, no such arrangement is total. And through the harshest such winter, one can still sow the seeds for a new spring.
We will talk about the U.S. left's failure to understand Syria at length, but viewed from a broader lens, the Western left has failed to fully digest the fact that the Arab Spring that erupted in 2011 was a repudiation of the states that came out of the anti-colonial movement in the Middle East and North Africa. In 2006, Albert Memmi's masterful Decolonization and the Decolonized appeared in English translation, And this book goes a long way towards correcting this failure in leftist thought. Quote Memmi, "The end of colonization should have brought with it freedom and prosperity. The colonized would give birth to the citizen, master of his political, economic, and cultural destiny. After decades of imposed ignorance, his country, now free, would affirm its sovereignty. Opulent or indigent, it would reap the rewards of its labor, of its soil and subsoil. Once its native genius was given free rein, the use of its recovered language would allow native culture to flourish. Unfortunately, in most cases, the long-anticipated period of freedom, won at the cost of terrible suffering, brought with it poverty and corruption, violence, and sometimes chaos." Unquote. As we saw in the discussions regarding capital, the Civil War, the Russian Revolution, and the Spanish Civil War, and all the rest of it, when we discuss a historical epoch, event, or conflict in terms of ideological character types, as chess pieces moving around a board with well-defined rules, we rob people of their humanity and agency. When instead of that, we consider people's basic humanity, their ability to make choices given a particular circumstance, and then intensively investigate who they were, why they did what they did, then we always seem to upset the predetermined narratives. Memmi does all of that for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in decolonization, not blaming either side for their own victimization, but also not letting anyone off the hook for their disastrous mistakes. Consequently, he is able to do something few who write about the Middle East, especially leftists, have attempted: to consider the actions of the various governments in the Middle East and North Africa as equally worthy of criticism, on an equal moral standing with any Western government. He is therefore able to discuss the failures of these governments in terms of what the peoples in the Middle East are responsible for, and in terms, therefore, of what they can do to improve matters. His book, Decolonized, foretold the Arab Spring, identifying its causes, systemic inequality, and corruption. I highly recommend reading Memmi. In this podcast, we have discussed the failures of one particular regime, that of Hafez al-Assad, and will return to discuss the revolution against him. But first, we want to discuss a form of left nationalism that in some parts of the left leads the way in understanding anti-colonial struggle. We'll come back to Syria, but first we should enrich our understanding of the state type that is based on the worship of a benighted leader by coming to terms with High Maoism, which is what we'll discuss in our next episode. In this Democratic Socialist Almanac, I'm going to review the history of the socialist tradition in the light of the latest scholarship. I'll be talking about the good, the bad, and every one of us living in between. Once we've sorted out how we got here, we'll survey the paths now open to us and begin a discussion of where we want to go. Follow us on Facebook, support us on Patreon, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from. Thank you.